Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where educators go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top leaders across the globe. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Danny Sunshine Bauer.
This is episode number 158 with Elena Aguilar. Hi there, my name is Danny Sunshine Bauer. I'm a former classroom teacher and school administrator turned life and leadership coach. I'm also the host of this podcast where each week I share my conversation with top leaders from across the globe to help you accelerate your leadership development. In today's show with Elena Aguilar, we explore a number of interesting topics like the number one question about coaching and working on teams, wondering how to work with them instead of how to get them to do something, and the one area we don't talk about with relationship building. Today's podcast upgrade is 5 strategies to better know yourself. You can download it at betterleadersbetterschools.com/157-Elena-Aguilar or click the podcast upgrade link in the show notes page. Thanks for spending some time with me listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. But before we jump into the episode, I'd like to take some time to thank our show sponsors. A lot of school leaders talk about improving student soft skills to help them succeed in their rigorous coursework. The problem is that most leaders just talk about it without actually doing anything. You can improve your students' non-cognitive skills today by checking out an amazing program called Organized Binder. Learn more at organizedbinder.com. Well, hey there, Better Leaders. Today, I'm joined by Elena Aguilar, the founder and president of Bright Morning Consulting. She's trained thousands of educators across the U.S. and abroad in transformational coaching and team development. She's a regular contributor for Edutopia and EdWeek Teacher and has published 2 highly acclaimed books, The Art of Coaching and The Art of Coaching Teams. With an upcoming book titled Onward, Cultivating Emotional Resilience in Educators, anticipated to release in May 2018. Elena's expertise derives from over 20 years as a classroom teacher, instructional coach, and leadership coach working in diverse school environments. In her role as a consultant, she has partnered with leaders in public and private organizations across the U.S. and abroad. Elena lives in Oakland, California with her husband, son, and 2 cats. When she's not coaching or writing, she enjoys traveling abroad, photographing birds, hiking, drinking coffee, and reading fiction. Elena, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Danny.
So the first question I think we have to ask are, what are the cats' names?
Well, Mango is not an orange cat. He is a very sweet cat. And Serena is his non-sibling who came with him from the pound when we adopted them at 7 weeks old.
Love it. And how old are they about now?
Now they're 5.
Are they still doing crazy cat stuff? Or I remember the days of kittens. My friend Casey has Kip and Uru, and they were just a handful, you know, and so funny to be around. But yeah, I'm just curious about your cats too.
They are still doing more craziness than I would expect from 5-year-old cats. And they're completely pampered and adored, and we obsess over them just a little bit. So it might be fostering their infantileness. Yeah, their source of incredible amusement and joy in our house.
I love it. And speaking of joy, you know, it caught my eye in the bio in terms of traveling abroad. And believe me, we'll talk about your books. We'll talk about education and leadership in the podcast. Listeners, I promise we will. But in terms of traveling abroad, you know, is there a specific place that you just absolutely love, right? And you want to recommend to all our listeners, if they had one chance to go anywhere, where would that be according to you?
Oh, that's such a hard question. I love traveling. I'm obsessed with traveling. I most recently was in Spain, and that kind of blew my mind. I travel a lot to Costa Rica. My father lives there. He's Costa Rican. My family is there. And I love Costa Rica. But I would say the place that everybody should go to is Nairobi. And that might be a surprise to people, but I have been working with some educators in Nairobi for the last couple of years, and one in particular, and developing closer relationships with them. And I had a chance to visit Nairobi and do some work with coaches and leaders in their schools in the informal settlements, what they call the slums. And that was life-changing and transformational. And I just came back with a commitment to continue doing work with educators internationally and possibly to help American educational leaders learn with and from folks in other countries. So right now I've got Nairobi on the mind, and it's just a place that otherwise people would not visit, but there are some of the most incredibly passionate, warm, committed educators that I've ever met living there doing incredible work.
They totally should go to Nairobi. It needs to be on people's radars. My wife is Zimbabwean, and her favorite African outside of Zimbabweans are Kenyans. She just loves them. I haven't been there myself. I've been to Umtata, South Africa, 3 times working with a school, their teachers and their administrators. And we went to Cape Town this past summer. Wow. So Nairobi is definitely on the list. I need to go to Zim to visit her hometown of Harare.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah,
I know.
So listen, I'm going to Zimbabwe this summer and South Africa.
Oh, great. That is so neat. Okay.
That's so cool. Okay, well, this is another conversation then, because I'm working right now to make contacts with educators there, and I'd love to see if you have any recommendations. Yeah, amazing connection.
Cool. We'll definitely connect offline on that one.
I'm Jethro Jones from Transformative Principal, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts. Make sure you check out the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And get ready, because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
So now that I've gotten the cats and the travel abroad out of the way, let's talk about what inspired you to pursue this career in education.
Oh, that takes me back to being like 4 years old and teaching my brother how to read. I had an incredibly mediocre and boring K-12 experience. And when I was in high school, I loved history because of my family and life experiences. And I thought that the way that history was being taught in high school was numbingly boring. And it was turning off all my classmates from learning about history. And I thought, I want to be a history teacher when I grow up. I want to help kids see how fascinating and important and relevant it is to study what has happened in the past. Probably it was born there in the most boring classes ever.
I guess when you're in that experience and it just stinks, I mean, you know, you're not connected to the material at all. Was it something that was happening at home that you knew that there was so much more? Your parents had a love for history or something like that? Or was this something that you developed later? I'm just curious about that.
I was raised with an acute understanding of how geopolitical forces had influenced my personal life. I was actually born in London, England. Neither of my parents were British, but because of 1960s Cold War and political chaos, neither of them could live in their respective countries. And long story, they ended up in London, England. But my family had been affected for generations by historical forces, whether that was in Eastern Europe or Central America. So I knew about history because it was very personal. And I knew that it could also be really fascinating and exciting and a way for us to think about the present and what to do to remedy the injustices that we could see or experience in the present moment.
Do you see a connection between that love of history and what you currently do in your role at Bright Morning Consulting?
I do, definitely. My love of history, my interest in understanding history has so much to do with understanding and addressing the injustices in our world and in our education system today. And so that commitment, which was also a message that I got from my family growing up, which was, you are alive to do something about all the injustices in the world. And let me tell you about them and show them to you. And my parents, my grandparents were very explicit in helping me see the injustices of the world. And then they would couple that with the mess, and you are alive to do something about it. That's why you're here. And so that took me into education. It took me into teaching. I taught for about 12 years. And then I figured some things out in the classroom and I was successful. And other teachers would come to me and say, how did you get your eighth graders to produce that kind of writing? And so I started informally coaching colleagues. And then I moved into a coaching position that was part-time and then full-time. And then I started training coaches. And so that's that long path. that has always been about how do I address the injustices in the world? How do I help communities, my own and others, that haven't been served as they deserve to be served, find their power, their voice, get what they deserve?
I love that quote, Elena. You are alive to do something about the injustices in the world. And to the listeners that are, you know, enjoying this show, the same can be said to them. And you are alive, specifically placed, I would say, you know, at the school in the role that you have to make a big impact, to address the injustices in the world, to open up doors for access for all the kids so that they could grow into a really successful human being, right? Connected to society and enjoying life. And I really, really appreciate that quote. I'm wondering, you know, you talked about informally coaching colleagues and, you know, then it sort of matured what you did. But what was it about you? You know, what did you figure out about student engagement? And what did you figure out about coaching that your peers started to say, Elena, you know, teach me what you know?
So I was just remembering my very first few months teaching. And I actually started teaching as a substitute teacher. I wasn't, after college and after some experiences abroad, I was actually planning on going to grad school and pursuing sort of a professor track university gig. And I had a year during which I was studying for exams and applying to schools. And I started substitute teaching just as a way to kind of make some money. And I actually fell in love with teaching as a sub. And I would go into these classes and explain to students, this is the assignment that was left, sort of here are the expectations. You know, if you choose not to do it, that's your choice. And, you know, I was sort of like, look, these are the rules, do it or not do it, you'll deal with the consequences. And then I would often just sort of walk around and I started talking to kids and I started, this was all in high school, and I started asking them questions because I'm an insatiably curious person. And they started telling me all kinds of things and I would sit next to them and just listen to what they were describing about their lives, which were fascinating and challenging. And I never had any classroom management problems. It was amazing, not even as a sub. And I fell in love with teaching. I was like, this is what I want to do. And I think what I figured out is that it sounds so simplistic. And I almost want to like apologize for making it be this simplistic but listen to kids and connect with them and recognize their full humanity and honor who they are and what they tell you. And the rest of it is easy. The rest of it, the how do you get them to do the do now or be quiet or engage or try their hardest or find the intrinsic motivation. It's when you start with connecting with their humanity and you listen to them and they tell you all kinds of things and you refrain from judging them or telling them that, you know, they're making really bad decisions, because maybe they are, but it's about the relationship and the understanding, the rest of it is easy. And so when teachers would come into my middle school classes in Oakland and they would just sort of say like, how do you get your kids to do that? I can't even get my kids to sit down and be quiet, let alone produce, you know, writing like that or do a debate like that. I just felt like it just starts with listen to them, sit with them, honor who they are. And the same is actually true for when you're a coach working with teachers. There's this very fundamental, very basic skill set and inclination, disposition around curiosity and compassion that I think made my life as a substitute teacher easy and has since made the work I do really impactful and effective.
Yeah, it's powerful. And you know, it shouldn't be sort of this reminder that we need to give people, connect with your students, right? Connect with your staff. And using your words, you know, recognizing their full humanity. But at the end of the day, people want their work to matter, what they're doing. They want that to matter, right? They want to know that they're doing a good job. They want to be seen, right? We're answering this question. Do you see me? Do you know me? Right. Like who I am for real. And those teachers, those educators, leaders, doesn't matter, organization. When you're able to do that with another human being and get it, and they say, yeah, that's right. You understand now. Like what you can accomplish is, you know, the sky's the limit, right? Because, you know, you might read about this in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I've heard it described a number of ways, but it's that emotional capital. It's that relational capital that you're building up and up and up because you see and you know the people that are in front of you. And then when push comes to shove and hard things need to happen, you have that capital that you can spend. And in the case of, you know, the classroom, they're producing this beautiful writing for you, right? I'm not sure that they were really excited about that at first to put in that type of hard work. But, mm-hmm. you know, because teacher knows me, right?
Right.
Or Professor Aguilar knows me. Right. I'm going to put in this effort. I want to impress her with this paper today. And I really appreciate your approach to the work in that sense.
And I think it's one of the top directions that I coach people in, whether that's a teacher or a principal. So the number one question I get about coaching, the number one question I get about working with teams, or it's just the all-time number one question, is how do I deal with a resistant teacher? How do I deal with a team that won't do anything that, you know, I ask or that I suggest, or how do I deal with resistance? And it's such an important question. And very simplistically said, you can melt away a lot of resistance having built that relationship, that relational capital, that listening to people, connecting with them, understanding who they are, and understanding how to work with them as opposed to how to get them to do something, but how to work with them. And so, you know, especially at the beginning of the school year, I'm always working with leaders around, you know, you've got all of these goals and plans for the year, and that's great. And that's really important. And where's your plan for relationship building?
Boom.
How are you going to develop community?
Yes.
You know, and let's actually make some goals around that and not just have it be a soft sort of hope or an intention, but actually how is that, that needs to be the number one leading goal or project? How are you going to get to know your people? And it doesn't just stop after a few social hours and human bingo activities. Like, this is ongoing, and it's what people need and want. And it'll make the rest of the year so much easier.
Yeah, I want to get to that relationship building in a second, but a very quick soapbox, if you'll permit me. Last night, I interviewed the Kansas State Commissioner of Education. And his episode's getting released, you know, differently than yours and whatever, that's fine. But chronologically, these interviews happen for me, you know, day after day. Mm-hmm. It was so refreshing to hear him say, if I go to a PLC meeting and all I hear is a discussion about student data in terms of, you know, standardized tests or formative assessments in general, it may be a little bit about discipline, we're missing it as a school. Mm-hmm. And wow, to hear a policymaker at that level get it and honestly say it, because the point was, when they're trying to live out their vision for them to be to lead the world in education and success for students, you got to recognize there's so much more, right? Mm-hmm. Than even for you, you love history. There's so much more than history to life, you know, mm-hmm. and what we see in front of us. That is a complex human being. And so, yes, I want to dig into this in a second. Like, how do we block off time, and how do we build those and nurture those relationships? But the other interesting thing too here is I missed social media marketing world this year, and it stinks. That's because I'm in Belgium and I'm waiting on my travel visa myself and all this kind of stuff. But my friends went, had an awesome time and learned a lot. Here's the craziest thing that came out of social media marketing world. It's all about social media. It's all about all these apps we use, communication, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody was pushing, of course, video, but more importantly than that, getting back to just a human face-to-face relational experience. So I'm kind of going on a tangent. What does marketing and social media have to do with me as a leader in education? It's more than the test score. It's more than all these other things. It's the human experience. And to use your words again, do we recognize our people's full humanity? All right, so I'm off the soapbox and I want to put you as a hero of the podcast. And I want to hear your thoughts, Elena, in terms of developing deep and strong relationships with your staff. And maybe for listeners that have never really thought of it, or they just know they want to level up their game, you know, what tips and tricks, what strategies do you have for us to go all in on seeing those people and developing relationships with them?
So there's a lot of stuff out there that people can draw on, and a lot of really useful stuff. I find one of the areas that isn't talked about as much when we're talking about relationship building is the absolute primary need for you as a leader, as a coach, as whomever, to know yourself, starting with yourself before you start pulling on strategies to have hard conversations or build community or listen to your community, whatever it is. It starts with you knowing yourself and knowing who you are, everything from how you like to give and receive appreciations, how you deal with criticism, how you experience conflict, what your personality type is, your tendency towards introversion or extroversion. All of that plays a role when you're connecting and trying to connect with somebody else. The who you are, what triggers you, how you deal with other people having strong emotions. It is your own emotional intelligence, starting with that. Your awareness of what, you know, yes, what triggers you, what gets under your skin, what are the words or the phrases that someone uses? Because then when you're in a conversation with perhaps a new staff member and you're trying to get to know them and they use a phrase that's one of those that sends you off, at least inside, what happens when it sends you off is you really start shutting down from the conversation and the other person. There's nothing sort of wrong with the fact that you're triggered. Maybe the other person says something like, you know, well, when I was teaching in that community, you know, I could only do this and that, you know, because those kids. And it's that phrase, it's the these kids with a negative implication to the tone, you know, a deficit mindset that's sort of coming up. And yes, that's problematic. But what happens to so many of us is when we're triggered in a conversation, we start shutting down and disconnecting and going into a sort of defensiveness mode. And it really gets in the way of that building that true connection and of remaining open and curious and compassionate. And so that we need to know ourselves. And then when we get into conversations with people, we know how to be in the conversation, but not have our ego at the center or our own beliefs or our mindset. And we can truly look for how to connect with someone else's humanity. And that's the same thing that's true for teachers who are working with kids who I do a lot of coaching around middle school teachers around what's called, you know, classroom management. And often when it boils down to it, what comes up in the conversation is something like, but that student is so disrespectful to me. And she rolls her eyes at me all the time. And it's those, like when we start boiling it down to the things that get under our skin that then send us closing off, shutting down, unable to redirect the student or the conversation in a way that's ultimately helping us reach our goals. So that's what I would say. We got to start with knowing ourselves. We need to learn something still about conversations and how to have them. So often when we're in conversations and we're listening, our mind is wandering all over the place and we're making judgments about what the person is saying, or we want to jump in and tell a story, or there's all these places that our minds go to when we're listening. So we need to start with understanding the different ways that we can listen and actually practicing listening and strengthening our listening muscles.
Let's stay there and talk about that for a second. My golden tip for the listeners, a mindfulness practice or meditation really helped me with that, because what you realize is that you don't have to be this, you know, quintessential like monk in a robe and serene and calm and meditating for like 6 hours that makes you get some type of reward from it. Everybody sucks at meditating. That's the secret. And when you lose track of your thought, you realize it, you notice it, and then you come back to the breath. And that's helped me in listening, because even during these podcast interviews, it happens all the time. It has nothing to do with the content or the quality of what the guest is sharing, but your mind wanders. And so you realize it and you go, okay, I want to be fully present in this conversation. I need to listen. I'm not listening right now. Mm-hmm. And it's just constantly reminding yourself. But for our listeners, and you know, since you're the expert, Elena, you know, what could we do to level up our listening skills?
I'm totally with you on meditation. I have been a meditator for decades. Sometimes I will admit I go on, I go off of my good meditation practice, but the concept of cultivating non-judgmental awareness, whether it is in the sort of more traditional sitting meditation, focusing on your breathing, or walking meditation, or various other forms of mindfulness that we can practice, has been key in my life. And I would say it's key for listening. It cultivates that self-awareness of what are your triggers, what sets you off. And it's really, I mean, it's key for resilience. There's a whole chapter in my new book, Onward, about the chapter's called Be Here Now. and it is about how to be in the present moment. It is a, there's a big plug for meditation in there because it's key to being effective at what we want to do, at fulfilling our purpose as educators. It's key to cultivating our resilience and being able to manage the challenges, whether that is an eighth grade girl rolling her eyes at us day after day after day, or a staff member who seems resistant and pushes back on everything. And ultimately, I think mindfulness is a remarkable tool for just enjoying life. And it's this sort of fleeting, wonderful experience that we have. And mindfulness, more than anything, helps me be in the present moment and to pay attention to what's going on and enjoy it.
So I'm glad you brought up Onward. And I wonder if we could switch gears a bit. And if you could just tell us the story of writing that book and what you're most excited about. By the time this episode releases, the book is out. So listeners, that's linked up for you in the show notes, and definitely encourage you to check out Onward, Cultivating Emotional Resilience in Educators. But yeah, tell us the story of writing this text.
I think I write every book that I've written that I write for myself, whether it's for myself currently or for myself at some other period of my professional life. So Onward is the book I wish I had had in my first year teaching, or my third or sixth or 12th year. It also has a companion workbook. And so between the two books, it's both the what is resilience, how do we cultivate it? Because that's the most important thing to know, is that it can be grown. And then very concretely, what can I do today, this morning, before I go to school, to cultivate my resilience? And that's what is in both of the books. The strategies, the what do I do this morning, is in the workbook. And Onward has a lot of the what, the how, the why, the stories. And the premise is that we not only deserve to feel good and manage the stressors and challenges, but we also, in order to meet, to fulfill our purpose as educators, the reason we got into this work, we also need more resilience. We need more, basically just more energy to be able to serve kids on a daily basis, or develop a positive staff culture, or whatever our project is. We need more access to the positive emotions. We need more strategies to manage stress and the challenges. And that's what's in Onward. The basic idea being that resilience is the ability not just to survive challenges, but actually to thrive in spite of them and to go farther, even though we've experienced challenges and adversity, and farther along our path at fulfilling our purpose.
Can't wait to check this book out. It reminds me of what something my mentor teaches me, and just trying to look at challenges as opportunities, right? Opportunities for growth. And how could I figure out, you know, how to navigate this situation? It gives you agency. It gives you ownership, as opposed to my default is, woe is me. I'm a victim. Like, why is this happening to me? I'm so much, you know, more deserving than this crappy situation or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if that's your mindset, like, oh man, life just really beats you up. And when you develop that resilience muscle, you could take ownership and actually see the positive in every challenge that comes your way.
Right. Or even just ask yourself, what can I learn from this? Even if there's no positives, the question, just asking yourself, okay, what can I learn from this? And actually what you raise is one of the keys to resilience, which I think about as I talk about is, like, how do you tell the story? What's the interpretation, the meaning that you make of the event? And so if you interpret everything as poor me, I'm a victim, you know, there goes my principal again, or the district is screwing us over, whatever it is, then that is going to dictate the actions that you see available to yourself to take. And if you can reframe the story and have different interpretations or expanded interpretations, then you are going to find many additional options for action and for responding to what's happening. So that's what the research says. That's definitely what my experience has shown, is that the way you tell the story is absolutely key in determining how much resilience you have.
How do we get at the truth of the story, right? This reminds me of something I learned from Brene Brown. And she tells a story of swimming across a lake and having this fight with her husband. But the huge takeaway for me is when she told her husband, the story I'm telling myself is this, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. And it opened up the dialogue to, like, whoa, you're way off. It's not that at all. It's actually this over here. You're not even close. And that was a game changer, right, in that situation. So how do we combat those stories, Alina?
The first step is to cultivate the awareness of the story you're telling, because so many of us are stuck in stories that we're not even aware that we're telling.
Right. It's like a silent narrative.
Yeah. And it can actually really help to also, in addition to your own sort of reflection and work, this is why coaching is essential, is critical. This is why, first and foremost, I'm a coach and I believe in coaching, because you often can't see or hear your own narratives. I have a coach. I can't imagine not having a coach, because we're in our stories. We can't see our blind spots often. We can, you know, there's many of them that we can, and there's some, the deep ones that are like, they just keep rearing their heads up and there they are again. We don't even see them. So, you know, you need other people to help you on this journey of life and leadership and cultivating awareness. You know, meditating is great because you notice your stories popping up. And then after a while, you're like, there it is again. There it is again. I guess I've got a narrative about being a victim, or the district is always trying to screw us over, or mm-hmm. what, you know, I can't ever do this. I'm not going to be able to do this in this community. This community is too broken. Those are narratives. Those are stories. And there's more than one story.
What would you say in terms of how to find a coach? How'd you find yours?
I got a recommendation from a friend, and that's probably a great way to go, is asking people, understanding what you want, because sometimes people want a coach, sometimes they want a mentor. There's a difference between the two. Sometimes what they need is more sort of traditional PD, but figuring out what you need and then asking around and advocating for, you know, if you need to get funds from your school or district, advocating for your right to PD. That's what it is. It's a way for us to keep learning.
Absolutely. And for a shameless plug here, listeners, you know that I work with school leaders in 7 different countries, 4 different continents. It's an international, what I call global leadership school. And if we could connect you to that at all and serve you and help you in your leadership position, check it out at betterleadersbetterschools.com/MM. So Alina, anything else on the book Onward that we didn't tease out during this discussion that you'd like to mention here before we move on and change directions a bit?
Well, I'm going to perhaps take inspiration from what you just shared and then go shameless plug.
Absolutely.
And just say, so Onward it's definitely the book that I am most passionate about, most excited about offering to the world, in part because I think it fills a big hole for educators of all kinds, whether those are teachers or administrators, central office people, counselors. Folks who have read advanced copies have said this will be helpful for anybody, including outside of education. My commitment has always been to people working within the education system, but I do hope that regardless of someone's position, they will check it out and see what resources there are for themselves and for other folks that they work with or support.
Absolutely. And listeners, you already know this, but again, the link to picking up Onward or any of Alina's books will be linked up in the show notes for you. So you just click that, put it in your cart, and purchase it, and you'll have it on your doorstep in 2 days or less if you're in the US and have Amazon Prime.
Thanks.
Cool. Today's show is proudly sponsored by Organized Binder, a program which gives students daily exposure to goal setting, reflective learning, time and task management, study strategies, organization skills, and more. Organized Binder's color-coded system is implemented by the teacher through parallel process with students, helping them create a predictable and dependable classroom routine. You can learn more and improve your students' executive functioning and non-cognitive skills at organizedbinder.com. Well, Alina, I love this quote by Derek Sivers. He says, "What's ordinary to you is extraordinary to me." So what do you consider your superpower?
My superpower, I would say, is intuition. I just have uncanny intuition. And the challenging thing for me has been to trust it and believe in it and listen to it. But whether it is grouping people in a workshop, connecting folks, colleagues who I know will just learn so much from each other, I get these immediate, strong, intuitive senses that I would say have helped me do what my grandparents told me I was born to do and helped me figure out what books to write, what workshops to do, what folks to connect. That's my superpower. Not that sexy or exciting as some others, but that's it.
Well, I think having an incredibly, you know, strong gut that leads you in the right direction, that's a really cool superpower.
I'll take it. I'll keep it. Yeah.
Yeah, take it. Absolutely. And, you know, the better leaders are always looking for routines and rituals to help them be more impactful. So is there any routine or ritual that you have? Maybe it's in the morning, maybe it's in the evening. Yeah, that helps you get the most out of each day.
You know, I'm going to sound like too many other people telling you, you got to meditate, you have to eat, you know, your leafy greens, get some exercise. But that is, the thing is that stuff works. And I know it's hard to fit it all in. And I think it's about figuring out, so how do we prioritize? What are we saying no to? Learning how to say no has been really critical for me in order to feel effective and be selective in what I say yes to. But it's given me a lot more space to say yes to things. I have some goals this year to explore and give more space to my creativity. And that has so far proven really helpful to me in my work, is giving myself a little bit more space to be creative. And I'm learning how to play the piano and doing some other things. And what I'm finding is that I have more focus and energy and excitement for some of the work that I'm doing, that I'm just seeing it in a different way because of what's happening when I'm exploring this huge, you know, domain that I'm calling creativity. So building that in every day. And again, then it's like, so what am I taking off the plate? What am I saying no to? How do I still manage to work, you know, a 9 or 10 hour day and spend time with my family and do, you know, exercise and meditate and all these other things? A lot of it is cutting back and limiting some of the things that aren't as nourishing, like social media, which I kind of hate to say, but it's true.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And let's give some tips for the listeners in terms of how to say no. And it could be a framework like what you'll find in the book Essentialism, where you have any opportunity that comes across your desk, what is the minimum criteria? And so given opportunity would have to meet all your minimum criteria, and then come up with some really challenging criteria called extreme criteria. And according to Essentialism, for an opportunity to be a yes, it has to pass 2 of the 3 extreme criteria and all of the minimum criteria. Or you might just memorize a quote. If it's not a hell yes, then it's a hell no, right? And if that's your filter, it makes it kind of easy to say yes to certain things and no to others. Or I want to give a shout out to Jessica Cabine. Love you so much. You're amazing, an incredible leader. She has a couple books coming out and she's blowing up. But what I love that she did in terms of saying no was getting together with her husband and establishing as a family, these are the number of conferences I can attend in a given year. These are the number of speaking engagements I can have. And once you know, okay, let's just say 5. I don't know what her number is. But if it's 5 speaking engagements, that first time you get invited, you got on, okay, I only have 5 to say yes to. Is this one worth it, right? Mm-hmm. So those are some tips I have for listeners. But Elena, what have you learned about saying no that's really helped you out?
Sometimes I do use a framework that I use when I'm coaching leaders, which is, can anybody else do this? Am I the only one who can do this?
Yes.
And that, whether that's for me in my business, delegating things that need to be done or things that I know I could do, but I don't, maybe don't need to, somebody else could do it. And so honing in on what is my unique gift offering, what is it that only I can do and that I'm really, really good at and that I really love doing? And so having that really clear, it doesn't mean that I don't also do some of the other things that need to be done, but it helps me recognize what I need to create the most time for. So that's been really helpful. Recognizing my own ego has also been helpful, because a lot of times I'm asked to do things and, you know, my ego gets all like excited and honored. And yet I have a coach person who says, imagine you have to do it tomorrow. And so if I get an invitation to present at a conference in northern Manitoba in the middle of January, and I imagine I have to go tomorrow and it's a 15-hour trip and it's going to be freezing and they only want me to speak for 45 minutes and they are a group of, you know, so then I go through this and I'm like, yeah, no, if I had to go do that tomorrow, I would not want to. But now, because it's like a year away, I can think, oh, maybe, because my ego gets all excited. Like, I'm so honored to be asked to speak at the Canadian Superintendent Conference. And so, you know, that's another filter that's helpful. It's been a lot of reckoning with, there's only so much amount of time and energy I have. And mm-hmm. So is this where I want to put it?
Yep. It could be that simple, right? Mm-hmm. It really can. Well, speaking of other quotes that I love, Tony Robbins is famous for saying, quality questions create a quality life. Successful people ask better questions, and as a result, they get better answers. So what's one question you would like school leaders to ask more frequently?
What brought you into this work? I think if we asked each other about our origin stories, what brought you, what motivates you, what compels you, there's that, and there's a partner question, which is, how do you want to be remembered? Whether that is when you retire or in some other moment, how do you want your students to remember you? How do you want your staff to remember you? How do you want the world to remember you? And it's, I think those questions get at our deepest motivations and commitments and often surface energy and excitement and passion and commitment.
And concerning leadership or education, have you or what have you changed your mind about in the last year or so?
Oh, it's a good one. I don't know. I can't think of anything. I would say a lot of times my thoughts sort of shift and evolve and grow and expand and shrink, and they're kind of all over the place. I'm cautious about having strong set opinions because I think that there's a danger in that, and our world has gotten into a lot of trouble in having absolutes. And so I try to hold a lot of softness and space around what I think and believe and do.
How'd you get into birdwatching?
You know, it's a form of mindfulness to me when I'm just sitting in some place and watching, whether it is on the California coast, watching pelicans fly, or as I mentioned, I spend a lot of time in Costa Rica with my family there, and they're the most amazing birds in Costa Rica, and they're hard not to be captivated by them. And I just find the way that my mind settles and quiets and focuses when I'm just fascinated by the way they're twitching their little heads or cleaning their wings or whatever birds do. They don't really do that much, but I just find them to be beautiful and peaceful and fascinating to watch. I say I'm a bird watcher, but I also say, like, when I'm an old person, I'm going to want to be a bird watcher, because right now I just spend time, I don't think I'm a serious bird watcher. I don't have binoculars.
Gotcha. Well, listeners, if you want to get Elena an amazing gift, send her some bird watching binoculars for sure. I have one more just fun question, then we'll wrap up the interview with my last three. But if you could be instantly great at anything in the world, what would that be?
I would be a singer, but I don't know what genre, because that would be really hard to choose. But I would be able to sing with a huge voice and a huge range. That's what I would do.
Cool. And what message would you put on all school marquees across the globe if you could do so for just a day?
Wish I could come up with something witty and sharp, but I think it would be something along the lines of love each other. I feel like as I get older, I'm just falling into these cliches that, you know, are really, it just keeps coming back to this message of love and recognizing each other as human beings and sitting down and listening to each other. It's like, they do feel like cliches, and they feel like, but the power in that is that there have been so many people for thousands of years who have been sharing this message of love and compassion. And that's what I see is that's what's transformed the world and people and schools.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Elena, I'm proud of you. You've made it to the end of the show, and this is quite a question. So spend some time here, but I'm curious, if you were building a school from the ground up and you're not limited by any resources, your only limitations, your imagination, how would you build your dream school and what would be your top three priorities?
I love that question. I would start with going to the community that I wanted to serve and getting them in on this question from the very beginning and asking them, what do they want? And I would have the kids and the parents and the grandparents and the aunties and the pastors and whomever is in the community out there helping to literally build the school and build it in a way that is what they want to see. And I would think about incorporating the things that we know cultivate resilience, like nature and fresh air and plants and flowers and beauty and artwork I would think about what the human body needs in order to be resilient and successful in school, which includes good food and rest. And so in the school, there would be gardens and kitchens where kids and community would cook, and there would be resting areas and napping pods and meditation rooms. And yeah, there'd probably be some yoga and some other ways to move your body and some dancing and singing. I would think about non-traditional schedules. And I have a 14-year-old now who is suffering with having to get up and go to school so early as his time clock, as his body changes and he sleeps in later. So we'd have late starts for our teenagers, and it would be a much more holistic experience. There'd be inquiry-driven learning, and students would explore the questions that they have, the problems in their community that they want to explore how to address and serve. There would be coaches for every teacher and leader, and perhaps multiple leaders in a distributed leadership structure. I can go on and on. I love this question. I think I have some ideas.
I think so too. It's a fun question. Thank you for engaging with it.
You're welcome.
Well, Elena, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can find me on my website, which is brightmorningteam.com. I am also on social media, even though I try to refrain from consuming a lot of it. It's just about limiting my time, but I am all over on social media and I do respond to messages and emails. And yeah, thank you, Danny, so much for this opportunity.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed this conversation a lot. Well, Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember, life's 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Danny and Elena. Head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Elena in the search bar. The show notes page will pop up and the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, including Elena's 3 books that we talked about today and the best way to connect. Elena, thanks for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you, Danny.
Better Leaders, just a few more things before you take off. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show. This helps gives the show some social proof, aka iTunes juice, and encourages new people to listen to the show. If you are a social media junkie, share your biggest takeaway from the show, and feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer. Take the letters, switch them around, and create something interesting and new. That's how I got it. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Do you want to get a short email from me every Sunday where I share the best resources I have come across, links to interesting articles, books, blogs, and podcasts that have challenged my thinking, and a quote that's inspired me and will inspire you as well? If you'd like access to this resource, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and join the newsletter at the top of the page. Over 1,000 school leaders subscribe, and I think you'll benefit from it too. In the newsletter, I also share when a new blog or podcast comes out, as well as different opportunities to work with me. Thanks again for listening to the show.